Welcome to the 286th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, a look back at week 10 in college football and week 9 in the NFL, a review of the conclusion of the World Series, and our first weekly review of NBA action for the 24-25 season. So let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com. We will start in college football, where Patrick went 4-0 with his weekend predictions. Similarly, in the NFL, Patrick went 4-0 with his weekend predictions. And in his first installment of NBA predictions, Patrick went 2-2 with his weekend predictions. That brings his total this week to a 10-2 record, and it brings his overall record to 1,154 and 736 overall. That now puts him above the 61% mark with a 61.1% overall winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, I thought obviously it was a very good week. I did not get a football prediction wrong. And of course, it's okay that the NBA didn't go quite as planned, because those games are always kind of hard to figure out, especially early in the season. You never know who gets affected by playing back-to-backs more. I picked against the Thunder because they were still undefeated and they were playing on the second night of a back-to-back, where they were in Portland and then in LA. I guess technically in Inglewood, I guess, would be the better description now that the Clippers have their new stadium. But, you know, got that one wrong. The Thunder beating the Clippers 105-92 to stay undefeated. They're still undefeated. The Hawks beat the Pelicans 126-111, which was a loss for me. But other than that, I got everything right this entire week. Continuing in the NBA, the Cavs beat the Magic 120-109, and the Timberwolves beat the Nuggets 119-116. Nuggets looking for revenge, of course, from the Western Conference playoffs last year. Didn't get it, which overall meant I went 2-2 in the NBA, like you said. Then going to the NFL, the Falcons beat the Cowboys 27-21. That was a win. The Ravens beat the Broncos 41-10. The Cardinals beat the Bears 29-8. And the Lions beat the Packers. All those wins, obviously, considering it went 4-0, it's kind of obvious. Can talk about more of the individual storylines in some of these games later, but, you know, Falcons looking okay, and the Cowboys just look like a dumpster fire that they are. The Lions, everybody talked about, could Jared Goff play in the weather, blah, blah, blah. It's the dumbest thing that they do every single year. I mean, he's played in the NFC North for like 3 or 4 years now. He knows how to play in bad weather. Even when he was playing with the Rams, he played in Seattle. I mean, it's really a stupid conversation. I don't know how this comes up every single time they leave a dome in the middle part of the year. I also have to say, it's not going to matter how well he plays in a dome or not in a dome when the Lions end up with the number one seed in the NFC and they play all of their games at home anyway, because then he's not going to have to play outdoors at the end of the season. So really, not a smart argument for anybody to make. I don't know why it's a topic of conversation. If you're talking about things that should be a topic of conversation, it's, are the Ravens the best team in the NFL, or are they at least in the conversation? And I think the answer is they're at least top three. And then also, can the Cardinals win the NFC West? I mean, is that a real possibility? But we can talk a little bit more about that later in conjunction with some other results. Then in college football, I went 4-0, picked a ton of road teams, or, well, I guess relatively a ton. I picked half and half. But Minnesota, the unranked team, went on the road and beat number 24, Illinois, 25-17. It's really hard to find a game where the ranked team is a home underdog against an unranked team. But I don't know, you know, I understand why Minnesota's not ranked based on their record, all that stuff. But I don't know why anybody would have gone any other way in this game. Minnesota has been on an absolute tear in the later portion of this season. I mean, they just don't look like the same team that started the season out. This is not even close to the team that lost to North Carolina on the first night of the season. I don't even think this is the same team that lost to Michigan on the road. I think if they played again, Michigan might lose that game. And part of that is due to Michigan's play. Part of that's due to Minnesota's play, mostly due to Minnesota's play. But I think, you know, it's also an interesting conversation because I believe that Minnesota does play Penn State at the end of the season. And that's something that people are underrating. You know, Penn State, everybody's just assuming is going to go 11-1. But they've had their fair share of struggles beating Minnesota in the past in big seasons where they should have. And I wouldn't be surprised if Minnesota, you know, even though they'll have momentum going into the game, they'll still be playing with house money. I mean, 4 wins in a row over USC, UCLA, Maryland, and Illinois is definitely a good stretch. But you know, Penn State just beat three of those four teams too, and then you know, swap out the Maryland win for a Wisconsin win, in Penn State's case. But they played those teams about as close, pretty much at the same margins that each other did. I mean, Penn State was in overtime at USC. Minnesota won by seven. It goes on and on. I don't need to go into the Penn State versus Minnesota thing yet because that's 18 days away. But I do think it's important to note that Minnesota has the momentum. And speaking of Penn State, they do not, because once again, James Franklin cannot win a big game. It is the easiest prediction of my life every single time picking against James Franklin. I did it again. It worked again. No, Ryan Day has, or yes, Ryan Day has had his fair share of struggles against top five teams, against Michigan. But you know, he's 3-6 against AP top five teams. Three of those losses are the last 3 years to Michigan. And one of those is also the loss on the missed field goal against Georgia in the playoffs. So when you're looking at it and kind of breaking it down, all top five matchups aren't created equally. All losses and wins aren't created equally. I think Ryan Day is a little bit better in big games than he's been given credit for. I think 2 years ago was the opposite, where after he lost to Michigan in 2021, everybody said, don't worry, he'll win this one and the next one anyway, because that's what he does. But now it's almost like we've overcorrected for that. And now we think that he's bad in big games, when in reality, I don't think that's actually true. I think he's just okay in big games. I mean, honestly, I think, you know, with the talent they've had, 3-6 isn't good, but with the circumstances surrounding those games, I think it's not terrible either. But Ohio State to get that win, I got it right. Then I picked A&M to lose. Just had the feeling of a team that was overconfident. You know, it's week 10 and they just named their starting quarterback for the season, like officially, instead of switching off between Connor Wigman and Marcel Reed, which had been working, but they just handed the keys to Marcel Reed. I didn't think that was a great environment to do that in, and it ended up being right. South Carolina, really good edge rushers on that team, two NFL bound guys, honestly. And they just dominated A&M, especially with that pass rush. And they got off to a big lead early in the game, which was a big key for them because their offense is sometimes stalled early on in games, especially big games. And then SMU destroyed Pitt. I mean, this was the proof that one of these teams, even though I don't know how this is an ACC game, but one of these teams is a true ACC contender and the other one is not, just a benefactor of a pretty weak schedule to start the season.
All right. Well, Patrick's predictions for next weekend will be posted on our website, 4thand24.com, as always on Thursday. Let's now turn our attention to college football with a look back at significant games from Week 10.
Starting with that game that I just talked about, Pitt beat SMU. Pitt again, or sorry, other way around, SMU beat Pitt again, number 20 in the country. SMU beat number 18 in the country, Pitt. Pitt did hang on and still stay ranked after this game. Don't necessarily agree with that. But you know, they're on the border anyway, it doesn't really matter. And SMU moved up into the top 15, but none of that matters because it's time for the college football playoff rankings tonight. So I will actually see what the real rankings are like tonight, the only ones that actually matter. And SMU will be right on that border of who's in as of tonight. You know, you're looking at a Boise State team that will probably be in the top 12. So it is pretty much just going to be the top 12 teams in the country in there. It won't be something where the group of five ranked or the highest ranked group of five champion is outside of the top 12 in the 12-team playoff. It will be teams 1 through 12, I would guess. I guess there's still a chance that they don't put Boise State in that group, but I think they will, and I think they should, and I have a feeling they will. It'll be close either way. But SMU, it's going to be interesting to see if they're just on the outside looking in. That's what I think will happen, even after all the upsets this week, which we'll get to in a second. But I do think that that they're still going to be on the outside looking in, but just barely. And you know, had they beaten BYU earlier in the season at home, they would 100%, maybe even be in the top 10. At this point, like BYU is, since they are undefeated, instead of having one blemish on their resume. But at the same time, SMU 8-1, a ranked win over Pitt, another good win over Louisville that might turn into a ranked win, and their only loss is to a top 10 undefeated team. So a really good resume that SMU is putting together. Just need to get maybe probably to 10-2, and if they're still able to make the conference championship game, which they are undefeated in conference, so it would be possible for them to make it there. If they can do that, they might actually be in the playoff as an at-large, even if they just make it to the conference championship game and don't win it. But we'll see. Then, speaking of upsets, speaking of conference championship games, Houston beat number 17 Kansas State 24-19. They were losing this game 19-10 in the fourth quarter. It felt like business as usual. Kansas State had a 16-10 lead at the half. They added on with a field goal in the third quarter, and then they just completely stalled out and let Houston back into the game. Houston was one of the worst teams in the country for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the year, and they were projected to be the worst team in the Big 12, or at least down there in that mix. And all of a sudden, this team's just kind of come out of nowhere. They're now 3-3 in the conference. I know that doesn't seem like much, but this team should not be sniffing a bowl game. And they only need to go 2-1 to end the season to actually make that a thing. And they just beat the top 20 teams. There's nothing saying they can't do it. Still, crazy upset. One you can't afford for Kansas State. I would say definitively this does take them out of the playoff race as an at-large. I don't think that they have enough left on their schedule to afford another loss, because the fact of the matter is they're either going to win out and be in the conference championship game and then lose and be 10-3, or they're going to not win out, which means that they won't be in the conference championship game since they already have two Big 12 losses. So you can eliminate them off the board. You can't quite eliminate Clemson, who is the number 11 team in the country, but did lose this weekend to Louisville at home. Louisville improves to 6-3 on the season, but 4-2 in conference. That 33-21 victory on the road is a very, very important one, obviously. But especially when you consider that Louisville now has a tiebreaker over Clemson, should Clemson lose another game in the ACC. Still important, though, that Clemson, one of their losses is to Georgia in the non-con, so they honestly had the leeway to lose another game in conference because of the fact that they hadn't lost in conference yet. They're still third in the conference. Their Pitt is 3-1. They're in fourth. Louisville, one of the two-loss teams in the ACC. Louisville sitting at fifth there. But then obviously Miami and SMU, the two undefeated teams, are in first and second. But it's important to note, SMU, of course, could still lose a game later in the season. I don't know that they will, considering they play Boston College, Virginia, and Cal. But Miami, I could see them maybe losing at Syracuse, maybe at Georgia Tech. Those are tougher games. They've had their fair share of close calls this season. I don't know if it's going to happen, but Clemson still is in the race. I just don't think they're all that likely to capitalize on it, just based on the fact that the teams that are ahead of them just don't feel like they're going to lose. But that would be devastating for Clemson. This loss already devastating enough, kind of throwing them in the same boat that Kansas State is. And then you have Texas Tech, who went on the road. Pretty much the same story as Louisville in the conference. Kind of not necessarily came out of nowhere, but a team that was supposed to finish in the middle of the conference and ended up really rising the ranks and being an impressive team in this conference, which kind of came out of nowhere. Not really. Like I said, they're 6-3, they're 4-2 in the Big 12. They are all of a sudden a factor in that conference's race. When you look at the fact that BYU was undefeated, they're number one. You have Iowa State and Colorado, who are both 4-1 in conference. And then right behind them, Texas Tech and Kansas State at 4-2. And then you also have West Virginia, Arizona State, and Cincinnati, who are all 3-2 in conference. But if you're looking at Colorado and Iowa State, it is important to note that Colorado plays at Texas Tech this weekend. And Iowa State, of course, just lost to Texas Tech. And they still have to play Kansas State at Utah versus Cincinnati and at Kansas. I know Kansas hasn't been good, but they still have a lot of talent on that team. So if I'm looking at things and I'm Texas Tech, I'm saying we beat Colorado this weekend, we should be in the conference championship game. I mean, arguably, you're just relying on Iowa State losing one more game, which is definitely possible, or BYU losing two games. But look, Texas Tech has the chance to at least swing it in their favor by taking Colorado out, who of course is tied for that spot at 4-1. And also now they have the tiebreaker over Iowa State. So if they were to end up tied, Texas Tech would go to the Big 12 championship game, which big win and big implications for the Big 12. Then you have South Carolina. They moved to 5-3 on the season. I said last week that this is probably the best three-loss team in the country. And I said, you know, you're looking at a Vanderbilt being ranked, and I'm saying, why not South Carolina? I don't care about wins and losses. At least they've played somebody. And well, they proved it this weekend. This is exactly the type of result I was expecting from this team. The SEC does have too many ranked teams anyway, so I'm definitely not advocating for them to be ranked with Vanderbilt. They could be ranked instead of Vanderbilt. But overall, you're looking at a really good South Carolina team. People seem to forget that on the road, this team lost by 2 points at Alabama, lost because they could not get a 2-point conversion. They lost at home on a walk-off field goal miss. against LSU. And then the only time that they actually got dominated all year long was that loss against Ole Miss, where Ole Miss won 27-3 on the road at South Carolina. But if you look at the other games in the season, they beat Kentucky 31-6. They beat Oklahoma 35-9, and they beat A&M 44-20. And this weekend, they play at Vanderbilt with a chance to really, really prove themselves, get another ranked win. They are 3-point favorites in that game. So I guess Vegas does agree with me rather than agreeing with the AP poll. But speaking of the SEC, then you have Kentucky. They took on number 7 Tennessee. Tennessee won this game 28-18. Squeaked out a victory. Wasn't necessarily clean. That was kind of a theme in the SEC this week. Speaking of that theme in the SEC this week, a win is a win for Tennessee and a win is a win for Georgia. Carson Beck looked horrible again. He had thrown 6 straight interceptions with no touchdowns at some point during this game when he had thrown his third interception and still hadn't thrown a touchdown pass. They almost lost to a third-string quarterback at Florida. I mean, this team is not the number two team in the country. It's just not possible. There is no way that there aren't more than at least two or three teams better than them. I am a firm believer that Ohio State is better than Georgia at this point in the season, at least, because frankly, they both had their big tests. Georgia passed theirs by beating Texas, but also failed the other one by beating Alabama. And Ohio State had a big test when they beat Penn State this weekend. They passed that one, and they failed the Oregon test, but even that was a 1-point game where they were literally seconds away from getting a field goal off and winning a game. And Dan Lanning exploited a rule that literally got changed the week after. So you could argue that Ohio State basically won that game. I mean, I'm not, they didn't, it's a loss, but they definitely were a lot closer in that game than Georgia was to beating Alabama, in my opinion, even though those were both very, very close games. But Ohio State, like I said, we already talked about it earlier. They beat Penn State 2013. Sticking in the Big Ten, Minnesota beat Illinois, as we discussed earlier. Talked about that season outlook for both of those, for all four of those teams, really. Although I guess should mention that Ohio State has a big clash coming up with Indiana in the near future. That will probably decide who takes on Oregon in the conference championship game because Oregon has relatively weak schedule. At Michigan was probably their hardest game left, and they just won that game. But Indiana plays against Michigan, then has a bye week, then has to go to Columbus to take on the Buckeyes. So that will probably determine the Big Ten race. If Ohio State wins that game, they'll get the tiebreaker over Indiana, and they'll rematch Oregon in the Big 12 in the Big Ten championship game. If they lose that game, then it'll be Indiana and Oregon, the undefeated, in that game. And then finally, number 19, Ole Miss demolished Arkansas 63-31. Really good result for Ole Miss after they had kind of squeaked by against some inferior teams, putting up a ton of points on the board, setting school records. That's what they should be doing in some of these games that they really, really want to earn some style points back before the first playoff ranking.
All right, well, you're making some big assumptions about wins and losses in the Big Ten, but needless to say, they're all going to shake out pretty soon. All right, that wraps up our look at college football for the weekend. Let's keep it with football. Turn our attention to the NFL with a review of Week 9 action.
Well, the Colts beat, or excuse me, the Colts lost to the Vikings on one of the sloppiest Sunday night games I've seen in a long time. The Vikings, 21-13 was the final score of this victory for them. They didn't score until the second half. They absolutely dominated the yards battle in this game. But it just, like I said, it just wasn't very clean. I mean, Sam Darnold had 290 yards and 3 touchdowns, but he also threw 2 picks. The only touchdown that the Colts scored all game was a defensive touchdown on a fumble by Sam Darnold. So, yeah, I mean, their defense was great. They only gave up 2 garbage time field goals, pretty much. Their offense was just a little bit sloppy, but they still ended up putting up 21 points. So you can't be too mad about it, although they also had like 30 possessions because Indianapolis just cannot hold the ball at all. But then the Lions beat the Packers. We talked about that in weekend predictions. This is a little bit of a light NFL recap. Most of these matchups this weekend really didn't mean anything for anything, so I'm just not talking about most of them. But the Lions beat the Packers, obviously very important in that NFC North race. Continuing with that theme from the Vikings. Now the Lions in first, Vikings in second, Packers in third. So we got that all figured out. And the Bears, of course, in last after their loss against the Cardinals, which, haven't talked about it yet, but of course the Cardinals now at 5-4 are actually leading the NFC West. So that's a pretty good result for Arizona. Are they going to keep it? I don't know. This is typically about the point in the season where they just fall off a cliff. But no pun intended. But they have a different coaching staff now, so maybe it won't happen. I don't know. Can't tell you, to be quite honest. I will tell you that I would feel more secure saying that the Rams or the 49ers are going to bounce back from their injury struggles. And the fact that they're only a half game back of the Cardinals already is a pretty good sign for both of those teams. But at the same time, I can't say definitively that the Cardinals are just going to magically forget how to play football for the second half of the season like they have in the past few years. But I will say the Rams in their next four games, they already got over the tough part. They played three playoff teams and then three terrible teams in their next six. They beat two of the three playoff teams they play, beating the Vikings and the Seahawks. And then they now play the two-win Dolphins, the two-win Patriots, the two-win Saints, and the only tough game in there is against the Eagles at home, which I honestly still think is a winnable game for LA. They've looked completely different since they've gotten their guys back from injury, including this 26-20 victory in overtime in Seattle. A big, big game to swing the divisional race. Obviously, Seahawks would have been 5-4 with a win, and the Rams would have been 3-5, but instead the Rams climbed to 500 at 4-4, and the Seahawks fall to last in the division at 4-5. Like I said, big implications. And then speaking about the Dolphins, they are now 2-6 after their loss at Buffalo. That was a game that Miami really needed to win. I mean, they're going to have to beat Buffalo at some point this season. They already failed to do that twice. And, they just don't have many games left on the schedule to make up for the fact that they started the season 2-6. I know that it's the factor of not having Tua. I understand. I'm not saying that, this team is horrible or they really underachieved. It's kind of what you expect when you have that as your quarterback situation. But, they now have at Rams, at Packers, at Texans left on the schedule, a game against the 49ers at home. They're going to have to win at least two of those three games and go undefeated in the rest of the season to have a shot at the playoffs. And I just don't see that happening just in the typical flow of an NFL season. That's just not really what happens. But meanwhile, the Bills still cruising along in the AFC. I talked about the Falcons already in their win over the Cowboys. They are now really seizing control of that division. I mean, it feels like it was just handed to them, but that typically does happen in the NFC South. If you're just an average team, you typically end up winning that division pretty easily. The Buccaneers, of course, have lost three in a row after their hot start because they're just banged up, and Chris Godwin's not coming back likely this season at all. Mike Evans still dealing with his injuries. And meanwhile, the Falcons have built a giant lead. They're 6-3. The Bucs are second at 4-5. And of course, the Panthers and the Saints are sitting at the bottom at 2-7. And then finally, I will close out with the Ravens just demolishing the Broncos. The Broncos at 5-4 are still not in a terrible position. When it comes to the playoff race, they are actually in the seven seed currently, which means they would be in the playoffs if they started today. But of course, Cincinnati's right there behind them at 4-5. And, I'd rather rely on Joe Burrow than Bo Nix, even though they might be the same age. Joe Burrow has like 6 years of experience on Bo Nix. But the Ravens, I think, are the real story here, just dominating teams. And even though the Steelers are still winning that division currently, I would expect the Ravens to beat them when they play them and eventually seize control. But that's all I have for a little short rundown in the NFL this week.
All right, speaking of a short rundown, let's turn our attention to the NFL to a short rundown of the end of the Major League Baseball season with a review of the end of the World Series.
The Los Angeles Dodgers won the World Series in five games. Game four is where we left off. The Yankees won 11-4. The annual, I shouldn't say annual, but the bye, no, just the every series meltdown from Jack Flaherty that did happen throughout the postseason. And the Dodgers were not able to pick him up offensively this time, unlike they did, or I guess which they did do against San Diego, but failed to do against the Mets. So Dodgers lost that game. And then it looked like, it was a rough one. They had the bullpen game going in game five, but the Dodgers were losing that game 5-0. And it looked like, wait a minute, we're going to go back to LA. It's going to be Yoshi Yamamoto against, or excuse me, I think I flipped the order of those games. Yeah, the bullpen game was game four. The Flaherty game was game five. I don't know why I flipped that. But yeah, Flaherty gave up a ton of runs. It was 5-0 Yankees early on in that game. And it looked like all hope not necessarily was lost for the Dodgers. Obviously, still would have had a 3-2 lead going back to LA. But Yamamoto versus Rodon, the Dodgers won the first game around. But Yamamoto had been up and down-ish in the playoffs. He really only had one bad start, but It's still his first MLB postseason, so there were some jitters there. Whereas Rodon had been kind of steady, other than giving up the home runs that he did, but the Dodgers had kind of lost their power stroke over the course of the series. But what the Dodgers didn't lose was their ability to just put the ball in play and force a fundamentally terrible Yankees defense to just make mistakes. And that's really all that happened. Just an opposite field single to start off an inning by Kike Hernandez when the Dodgers were down 5-0. And then just a slew of errors that led to the Dodgers getting more base runners. I mean, I think we were on the phone talking about this. We basically said the Dodgers had six outs in the fifth inning, basically, where Aaron Judge dropped the ball. That was one extra out. Will Smith grounded out, but then that was a throwing error. So all of a sudden, the Dodgers had bases loaded on a single and two errors. And instead of, really, I mean, frankly, it could have been out of the inning. If Volpe fielded it cleanly in the first place, could have been a double play on Smith, although I guess there wouldn't have been anybody on base. But anyway, it at least would have been two outs, could have been two outs. And then the Dodgers went back-to-back strikeouts from Gavin Lux and Shohei Ohtani, and all of a sudden the Yankees are thinking, okay, it's still 5-0. We're going to get out of this inning. They get a weak ground ball from Mookie Betts. This one wasn't ruled an error, but it really was. Gerrit Cole didn't cover the base at all. Anthony Rizzo waited for the spin of the ball because it was kind of a really weird ground ball angle, and he waited for it, but then Gerrit Cole wasn't covering, so that counted as an infield single, but it was really an error. And then all of a sudden, Freddie Freeman single, Teoscar Hernandez double. They just gave the Dodgers way too many opportunities. I mean, those Kike Hernandez had his single, Freddie Freeman had his single, Teoscar Hernandez had his double. Those were the three actual hits in this inning, but that does not give you five runs unless you walk players or put guys on base for free. And that's exactly what the Yankees did. And all of a sudden, after the Teoscar Hernandez two-run double and after Freeman's two-run single, it was tied 5-5 in the fifth inning. It is worth mentioning, though, the Yankees had opportunities again to close out this game. Alex Vesia came in the next inning. He let the bases loaded with a single, a hit by pitch, and a walk, but induced a flyout from Gleyber Torres. And then the Yankees actually did take the lead on a Giancarlo Stanton sac fly. But then Blake Treinen came into the game at the end of the bottom of the sixth and really just shut things down for the Dodgers while they had three innings of opportunities to get back into the game and take the lead for the first time. Of course, it was 5-5 at this point. They were down 6-5. Gerrit Cole did a great job finishing out through almost the end of the seventh inning. But Clay Holmes eventually brought in. He walked one batter, struck out Max Muncy to end that inning. And then all of a sudden, Blake Treinen was just nails for the Dodgers. Went 1-2-3 in the seventh inning. Like I said, he was brought in the sixth inning with guys still on base. With the first and second and two outs jam, he got out of that with a ground out. And then the Dodgers woke up in the top of the eighth. Tommy Kahnle finally could not just throw changeups straight by people. Dodgers had seen him many times before in the series, and they got a single, an infield single, and then a walk to blow the bases. Yankees brought in Luke Weaver, and he did a great job, honestly, getting out of this inning. But unfortunately for him, he wasn't helped out by his fielders and wasn't helped out by the fact that it was bases loaded and nobody out when he came in. The Dodgers did not get a hit for the rest of the inning, didn't get a hit off of Luke Weaver. It was just a sacrifice fly, then a catcher's interference that loaded the bases again, and then another sacrifice fly by Mookie Betts to give the Dodgers a 7-6 lead. Gavin Lux had a really rough series, but he did come through when it was necessary, putting the ball in play instead of striking out. And like I said, the Dodgers just consistently put the ball in play, even if they didn't have their power stroke in this game. Did not hit a home run here at all, but they just put the ball in play, and the Yankees on defense are going to struggle. It's exactly what happened. And the Dodgers won because of that, obviously had the 7-6 lead, trying and pitch the eighth, and then finally ran out of gas, which meant that the last guys in the bullpen were Daniel Hudson, Ben Kasperius on no rest, Landon Knack on no rest. Hudson also on no rest, I should say. And then Walker Buehler on one day rest. And of course, as we now know, Dave Roberts went to his starter out of the bullpen. And the move that has come back to bite the Dodgers maybe five or six times in postseason games over the last, what, 11 or 12 years. You think about Clayton Kershaw meltdowns in the past. It worked. It worked for the second time. Julio Urías did it in 2020. Of course, no longer with the team for good reason. But Walker Buehler will always have that moment. It's his crowning moment in Dodger Blue for sure by closing out the 2024 World Series out of the bullpen when probably no one thought he would even be in the conversation for that, especially given his inconsistency throughout the season. But still, there was a stat out there that he has like a 0.5 ERA in the World Series. I think he has the best World Series ERA of all time from anybody who's pitched 20 plus innings. He just elevates in the playoffs. It's him and Kike Hernandez who both were terrible in the regular season. But the fact of the matter is, you keep them on the roster because of what they can do in the postseason. And once again, it paid off for the Dodgers. Just a great job all around throughout that organization to get this win. And frankly, the Dodgers will be better in 2025 when they get Tony Gonsolin, Dustin May, Emmett Sheehan back. Tyler Glasnow will start the year healthy at least. And Ohtani will be back pitching. So the Dodgers will be better in 2025. And that's a scary thought for the rest of the league.
Yeah, and you mentioned a great job all around by the Dodgers. I think Dave Roberts said there are fingerprints, or somebody said on the Dodgers, there are fingerprints on their World Series trophy from every guy in the room. You go look back, I think you and I could probably name off the top of our head 40 people who made some contribution due to all the injuries, whether it's in the regular season or the postseason. You mentioned even Gavin Lux. I frankly think the only person whose fingerprints might not be on that trophy is Austin Barnes. He might be the only guy of all the people who played for them that hadn't done something to step up significantly. Not to diss Austin Barnes, but I went through this list in my head, and he's the only guy I can think of who didn't do something
It's
significant.
not that
So
he didn't do something significant. He just literally never had a
didn't
plate
play.
appearance. So I don't know what he's
Even during the
supposed to do
right,
about
even during
that.
the regular season, right? There are guys who stepped up, like, Gavin Stone. Now I'm blanking on Ryan, River Ryan, who pitched a game here and there. Just to keep the team together when they were being devastated by injuries. I think Austin Barnes, the only guy who don't remember a moment. Maybe there was a game you remember that he had a significant
Well,
contribution.
he bounced back in general this year and had a decent season hitting, just like Miguel Rojas, guys who are really in there for defense that ended up actually having surprisingly good hitting seasons. But, when it comes down to it at the end of the playoffs, those guys were not going to be in the lineup over Will Smith, in the lineup over Kike Hernandez and Tommy Edman, but just not much opportunity for them to play. And obviously, with extra days off in the postseason, you don't have to switch catchers, which the Dodgers definitely weren't going to do and won't do if they're not forced to do it. But, it's clear that Austin Barnes is appreciated because they picked up his contract again for next year. Dodgers did not have to do that, but they did. They're two of their top five prospects are catchers, and Hunter Fiducia was even on the 40-man roster at the end of the year. So there are plenty of catchers to take his spot, but the Dodgers are still rolling with him as the backup. So I think that's proof enough that he at least has some impact on this team.
Yeah, well, congratulations to the Dodgers. And like you said, the scary thing is they're probably going to be better next year, certainly from a pitching standpoint. All right, let's move off of Major League Baseball and renew coverage of the NBA with a review of the start of the 24-25 season.
As much as I would like to talk about the two important games in college basketball or some of the other upsets, it's been one day in the season. So we'll just go with the NBA for now. We've been neglecting it because of the World Series. Now, of course, we'll keep having the NBA as a weekly thing, and college basketball will replace the MLB starting next week. But starting at the top of the Eastern Conference, you have the Cavs at 8-0, one of the league's two unbeaten teams, the other one being the Oklahoma City Thunder. In the West, we don't really have an agenda here in terms of, the most impressive versus most disappointing teams. That's obviously normally our format, but we're not doing that quite yet because it's the beginning of the season. So I'm just going to go through the standings and kind of point out some things that really jump out to me. Celtics starting out 7-1, that's about exactly what you would expect. The rest of the East is just not that good so far. No teams have jumped out. There are two teams above 500 in the entire conference. Meanwhile, every team in the West through team seven, that being the Sacramento Kings, are above 500. And the Nuggets are in 11th at 3-3. Meanwhile, a 3-3 record in the East would put you tied for third. So once again, the West way deeper than the East, just not particularly close. The Cavs and the Celtics do look dominant. Team that doesn't look dominant, it's the Milwaukee Bucks. At some point, we got to get around to it. Doc Rivers has not made a team better in a long time, and nor has Darvin Ham. And those are the two guys who are leading the show in Milwaukee. They have Damian Lillard. They have Giannis Antetokounmpo. They also have the worst record in the league. That is something that shouldn't ever be said with the talent that Milwaukee has. There's just no reason for them to have the same record as the Utah Jazz and a worse record than the Portland Trail Blazers or the LA Clippers. Frankly, no disrespect to Chris Paul and Victor Wembanyama, but they shouldn't be worse than the Spurs. They definitely shouldn't be worse than the Nets. I could go on and on. The Pistons, I mean, you can name any team. They're worse than every team in the league. The only team that isn't worse than them is Utah because they have the same record. And Utah just got their first win. So that was Milwaukee now getting tied for that worst record. And also, they have no momentum because they won their opener. They have lost six games in a row. And the Sixers at least have the excuse sitting at 1-4, by the way, which isn't any better, but they at least have the excuse that Paul George hasn't played. Joel Embiid still hasn't played. They're banged up. It is what it is. That's a big difference, a far cry away from being 1-6 with pretty much all your guys healthy, as far as I know. So the Bucks and the Sixers at the bottom of the East, definitely the big surprises. It's still early. The Pacers are 2-4, but it's 2-4. They win two games. All of a sudden they're at 500. Everything's fine. It's just really that the East overall is terrible. And the one thing that I would like to point out in terms of surprises that are positive, how about the Brooklyn Nets at 4-4? I mean, this team, they have no business being even near 500. They probably should be one of the worst teams in the East. Everybody's talked about how terrible they're set up for the future, given the lack of picks because of the KD, the Harden, and the Kyrie trades. And yet somehow they're still up here. I don't know what, I mean, they shouldn't be third in the conference. Obviously, that's just a factor of the other teams not playing up to expectations. But the Nets, the Knicks, and the Heat are the only 500 teams in the East. And like I said, the Cavs and the Celtics way above 500 dominating so far. But the Nets should not be in the conversation with teams like the Knicks, the Heat, the Celtics, and the Cavs. They just shouldn't be. And yet they are. It's a credit to Jordy Fernandez and his new staff there in Brooklyn. And if you want to say, okay, well, it won't last. Look, their point differential so far is negative 0.3. It is the fifth best point differential in the East. Every other team is worse than them in record and in point differential, other than the teams that they're tied with and the teams that they're behind. So for now, they do look like an average team. And I don't think that an average team is going to miss the playoffs, or at least won't miss the play-in entirely in the East, because I don't think there are I don't think there are 10 average teams in the East. I think you look at Charlotte, I think you look at Toronto, I think you look at the Wizards, and I think you look at the Pistons and the Bulls, and you say, those are the five teams that are going to miss it. The only team that really has an opportunity to sneak in there, you're looking at maybe some improvement from the Wizards or maybe some improvement from the Bulls to get above the Nets. But for now, I'd roll with the Nets as that 10th team, even though that doesn't really mean much. But, maybe they even play better. Injuries happen. Teams ahead of them, like the Heat, maybe even like the Magic, maybe the Hawks, could struggle throughout the regular season with some injuries. I mean, we're already seeing it with the Sixers. So credit to the Nets for what they've done so far. Not necessarily saying they're going to keep it up and stay at 500, but you don't really need to hover that much. I mean, all you need to do is really be within three or four games of 500 in the East, and you're going to make the play-in at least. And then you never know what happens. So I think it's worth giving the Nets some credit for that, especially with how bad they're supposed to be. And then moving on to the West, it's just a gauntlet out here. I mean, there's no other way to point it out. Like I said, the East only has two teams that are above 500. The West has seven. They also have four teams that are directly at 500. So it's deep. It's tougher than ever. I really am looking at these teams, and I'm saying 13 teams are legit playoff contenders here. The only teams that I'm looking at, and I'm saying no chance, it's Portland and Utah. I don't see them jumping into the mix. But look, the Clippers are 13th in this conference currently. And A, I'm not surprised by it. And B, it could definitely last all season long. I mean, they're 2-4. They're right behind the Pelicans, who are 3-4. They were a playoff play-in team last year. The Nuggets are at 3-3, and so are the Timberwolves. Obviously, those two upper echelon teams in the West. So expect them to get better throughout the course of the year. But you look at the teams ahead of them, they're tied with the Spurs and the Grizzlies. The Victor Wembanyama and Chris Paul combination has looked really good so far. I think they can stay near 500. I don't think they're going to make the playoffs, but that amount of talent, I'll say this. In the East, I would say they're a playoff team. And in the West, I can say they're at least a play-in contender, for sure. It's not like this is a fluky 3-3. They definitely have the pieces there. Harrison Barnes as well, who they brought in. Then all the guys who have been there, Keldon Johnson, Jeremy Sochan, they have pieces. I mean, this is a team that should be in the play-in conversation. And I could say the same thing about the Grizzlies, who obviously didn't have a great year last year, but that's just because Ja Morant missed practically the entire season. They're healthy again. Marcus Smart is back as well. And a healthy Grizzlies team is as good as any other team in the West. And we know that from how they've played in the past. And it won't shock me if they A, make the playoffs, or B, make some noise, maybe win a series, maybe two in the playoffs. Then you're looking at some of the other teams above them. Sacramento's got DeMar DeRozan, De'Aaron Fox, and Domantas Sabonis. That's a good enough team to be a playoff team. They were a play-in team last year. They broke the playoff drought the year before, almost beat the Warriors in that series. Speaking of the Warriors, they're one of the 2 1-loss teams in the West, along with the Phoenix Suns, who we know have a ton of talent. And then the Thunder are undefeated, like I mentioned earlier. You got the Mavs, who represented the West in the finals last year. They're at 4-2. And then you have the Rockets at 4-3 as well, and the Lakers at 4-3. The Lakers, obviously, looking very good under J.J. Redick, looking like a real contender again. Their offense is off the charts this season. Just need to hammer some things down on the defensive end, and they'll really be golden this season. And then you look at the Rockets, where this is a young team that has a lot of talent. I mean, there was a point last year, I think, where they had won like 15 of 16 games, and they were only a game or two out of the playoff race. They lost some steam at the end of the year, but they still have enough talent to at least threaten for the play-in. And like I said, there are at least 13 teams that I would call play-in contenders or better in the West, and I just named them all. Maybe two of those teams, the Spurs, the Rockets, I would say are more likely to be play-in teams than playoff teams, and I would still have them in that category for at least another few weeks. But that still leaves you with 11 true playoff contenders, and there's only room for 10. So the West, again, just as deep as ever. I might argue this is the best year of basketball that I've seen, or most lopsided year in terms of one conference being better than the other. The West is always better than the East, especially depth-wise, but this year is another level because these West teams, I mean, their draft picks have all been hits, and the Eastern Conference teams, I cannot say the same thing about. There are no Wembys. There are, frankly, I don't even think there are many Jalen Greens in the East. None of those picks have been as good as some of the picks these teams have made. Even the Grizzlies with Zach Edey. Zach Edey's looking amazing in Memphis in that combo with Ja Morant. So I'm just looking all around this league, and I'm saying, I don't know who's going to miss the playoffs in the West. Somebody has to, but it's going to be a really good team that ends up missing even the play-in entirely. You're going to be missing a Zion Williamson, a Kawhi, not a Jokic. I don't think they're going to screw that up, but you're going to be missing a Wemby. You're going to be missing Ja. You're going to be missing De'Aaron Fox. At least three of those guys are going to miss the playoffs. They're just superstars galore in the West, and it's really just an insane start to the season, and I don't think it's going to calm down before the end of the year at all.
All right, well, that wraps up our first look at the NBA. It also, for this year, it also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, November 12th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, review week 11 of college football and week 10 in the NFL, and we'll talk again about basketball with another weekly review of the NBA and a look at the start of the college basketball season. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including our college football rankings, which are posted weekly throughout the season on Monday mornings, Patrick's weekly college basketball bracket updates, which will be posted weekly on Wednesdays throughout the season starting tomorrow, and as we mentioned before, Patrick's picks for next weekend's games, which are posted as always on Thursday. All of that content is on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.